Some question?
Ah, yes, we got a question from Gopakishore Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Gopakishore, he is on loan. We've loaned him to America.
Yeah. Somewhere in scriptures describing Mahaprabhu's life, it was quoted to advise to be in position of Vaishya, not scientist or else. I think means advise others to be in Vaishya.
To be what?
In the position of a Vaishya, the position, the social.
Who's
position.
Advising?
Mahaprabhu.
He's advising someone to be a Vaishya.
Mm-hmm. Not scientist or else. So following question is regarding.
No, but what's a Vaishya or a scientist?
Not a scientist. Yes, in a
but
Vaishya.
But I mean those two things are a Vaishya. Anyway, and
so the following question is regarding this advice and for whom and
where is that advice?
Somewhere.
I need to know the source of that advice. Where is that written? Where is it expressed? Without that I can't comment on it.
So Mahaprabhu doesn't advise.
We've heard Mahaprabhu say Naham vipra nacha. He's saying he's not a vipra, a brahman, a vaishya. He's any of those things. But gopi bartur padakamalayo dasa dasanu dasa. So I don't think you have the source right.
Okay, but the
there's one place where he told someone maybe, you know, to cultivate material wealth and spiritual wealth, if that's the reference. But without giving a specific reference, I can't comment on that. And that's in the particular case of some devotee. But generally speaking, Mahaprabhu is saying he doesn't identify with Varnashram. His aspiration is to be, it says, Gopi Bartur Padakamalayo Dasa Dasanu Dasa, to be the servant of the servant of the servant of the Brajagopis, the Lord of the Brajagopis of Vrindavan. That's his actual position. That in some context, someone might have been advised some way, that's a specific thing related to them. But he's not promoting any Varnashram position. In fact, in the Ramananda Samvad, he rejects Varnashram. He says, Varnashrama charvata purushena purakpuman Vishnu aradite pungsan nadya tat toshakaranam. When Ramananda suggests Varnashram in response to Mahaprabhu's questioning about what's the target and how to achieve that, he says, that's external. Iho bahya agi kahuar. So he presents more. Everything is being told. Iho bahya agi, iho bahya, that's external. It's applicable in an external sense. Agi kahuar, go deeper, dive deeper. Guru Maharaj's expression, dive deep into reality. And the first thing that he says that Mahaprabhu accepts, Jnane prayasa mudapasana manta eva jivanti sanmukaritam bhavadi avartam stane stita shrutigatam tanuvan manobir ye prayaso jita jito piyasita istrilokyam. Stane stita shrutigatam. Whatever your situation is, begin hearing from Krishna's agent. That's your first contact with reality. The substance there in Harikatha, Krishna Katha. Krishna himself is present within his glorification. And hearing that from the heart of a pure devotee of Krishna's agent and expressing some appreciation from that, Mahaprabhu said, that's the real substantial thing, the real starting point. And he says, Iho hoi, this I accept. All the proposals you've made before that, I don't accept. But this I accept. Hearing about Krishna from his agent. And he says, Iho hoi, age kahor, now go deeper. Dive deep into reality. Saying, but this is the first contact point with reality, with spiritual substance. Other advice is given in relation to the external world is not of permanent character. It's relative. That we know. He says he's not interested in any varna or ashram. And his only aspiration is to become the servant of the Lord of the Brajagopis of Vrindavan. And the way that prospect becomes awakened in one is by hearing from Krishna's agent, from his devotee. That's our focus. Any other question?
His question got the second part.
Oh, okay.
In our preaching movement, we are using so many things developed by doers of this world.
And by who?
Like people from this world.
Oh, okay.
And level of consciousness is reflected in things people do. And common wisdom tells that you cannot overgrow somebody if you're copying or following their path and idea.
You cannot overgrow,
like pass them, surpass. Surpass somebody if you are copying or following their path and idea. Can you elaborate regarding this question on the principle of not using the divine as our servitor and transforming material consciousness into spiritual consciousness and highest consciousness?
We spoke a little bit about this the other night, that imposing from our position upon the higher, that's karma kanda. And allowing the higher to use us and whatever acquired skills, resources we have, that can be in the realm of service. Anashaktashabhishyan yutahum upayunjitaha nirbandha krishna sambandhi yukta vairagyam yuchite. We're following Rupa Goswami's principle that everything potentially can be used in the service of Krishna, that nothing should be rejected as mundane, on the basis of it being mundane, it cannot be utilized. Right? In the modern time, our example, Srila Saraswati Thakur. In a time when sadhus, didn't wear shoes or use any kind of conveyance. As we told the other day, he's, using a motor car in Vrindavan. He's acquiring printing presses. He's using whatever technology is available of that time as an instrument to propagate Krishna consciousness. So that's not following others, it's employing the situation they've created, taking advantage of that to propagate Krishna consciousness. Right. So, means one current, it's descending from the upper world, and it's pulling, it's a current that's taking toward that plane. The other is what Guru Maharaj sometimes calls the outcarrying current, taking away from that plane. And what's the criterion? What one is forgetfulness of Krishna, it's the outcarrying current, And that which brings about remembrance of Krishna is the in-caring current. So, in Srila Saraswati Thakur's time, he referred to the printing press as a brihad mridanga. That a mridanga can be heard for a certain distance, but the printing press is like a giant mridanga for propagating Krishna conception. And now we have the internet. So if the printing press is a brihad mridanga, then what would the internet be? Where it's possible to broadcast Krishna conception all over the world. We won't reject it saying, oh, this is technology made by asuras. So we don't use that. Then our reach will be very short. But by employing it, what's the principle involved? Is substantial Krishna consciousness being extended or not? That's the criteria. It's not a question of following others, but utilizing what they've created to propagate Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada would use the expression to dovetail. So in a sense, it means to co-opt, to repurpose something. We're repurposing the latest technology to broadcast Krishna conception. So in that sense, we those who are developing these things, we wish them well, because we'll be able to use these things to promote Krishna conception. Yes.
Because when we are preaching, we're using those tools.
You're asking me this question with a microphone.
Yes.
Right, and which is being filmed by cameras.
Yeah.
So that's the answer to your question.
And because we are doing programs, like projects, Fodom, other stuff, we're involved in much material elements. Sometimes we might be carried away, like fall victim to these things, although we want to preach in the first way.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, so you have to stay focused and true to your purpose and remember why you're doing these things. That's all. Just like soldiers in the battle, the wartime, they're doing many different things. Someone's a sharpshooter, expert with a rifle, but according to what the necessity is at that time, they may have to dig a hole. Pick up a shovel and dig a hole. There's the cooks, the mechanics. They're all doing many different things that are assisting this overall campaign. But it's possible they can become distracted or lose a sense of purpose along the way. Then they have to be thoughtful about what it is they're doing and what is the ultimate goal of these things. Yes.
So we are not to surpass the inventor's idea, but to utilize their resource to preach.
Pardon me?
I mean, he is mentioning we cannot overgrow others' ideas if we follow their path. So
I don't understand what is overgrow. That's the word? I've never heard that.
Maybe I think he means to surpass, to be better.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I don't understand the question.
I think he means that because we are using others' inventions to preach, and
right. So they're instruments.
Yes, and then we have this godly idea, like we have those films, those videos, then we are using those to present our ideas. Then
not our ideas.
Oh, yes.
See, that's the thing. It has to be descending. Follow what I'm saying in principle. What's descending? Revealed truth from the higher plane. We're using these things to, our ultimate goal is to express those things, express revealed truth. Srila Guru Maharaj says, Saraswati Thakur's motto was Pujala Ragapat Gaurava Bhange Matala Sarujana Vishayarange. And the Vishayarange, Guru Maharaj referred to as bait. Like sometimes you use bait to catch a fish. Right? The bait is an incidental thing. What you're trying to do is catch the fish. Right? The bait is incidental. So there are different things that may be employed temporarily to draw someone's attention, to redirect their attention towards something substantial. That's the idea. To become focused on the bait is to lose focus of what the ultimate purpose is. It's incidental to the goal, which is to catch that fish. So whatever these means are, they're incidental to the goal, which is to direct someone's attention to Krishna consciousness. Any other question?
Question from Chinese Danishta.
Hare Krishna.
She got a question for you personally. Why you'd pay much attention to preaching in China? Is it because China has a large population, so it's got much more potential followers? Or because the collective consciousness of Chinese have reached a critical point that they do need salvation?
Well, both of those are acceptable, but Mahaprabhu himself says, Prithibite ache jata nagaradigram sarvatra prachar hoibe moranam. He predicted that Krishna consciousness would spread everywhere. So, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur reiterated that over 100 years ago, that he envisioned people from all nationalities embracing Mahaprabhu's culture and the Krishna consciousness movement. So in Saraswati Thakur's time, they're preaching very successfully in India, but he wanted it to go to the West. And what were the leading countries at the time in the Western world? England and America. Right? So he wanted particularly that Krishna consciousness would be preached in English. Which means England, the UK, and America. So he sent his first preachers to London, and with the book Sri Krishna Chaitanya. We heard from Srila Guru Maharaj that toward the end of Saraswati Thakur's Manifest Pastimes, he expressed the desire to like preach in the West himself. So that preaching party he sent was like an advance party. He was prepared to go to the West himself. But then he left the world, as we recently observed in 1937. Srila Guru Maharaj paid Srila Swami Maharaj a great compliment when he said, actually, his 10 years of preaching in the West, approximately, he said, that was his gift to Prabhupada Saraswati Thakur. who himself wanted to go. So he said before he left the world, he said, oh, we didn't take it to, when I say, Markina Loka, I mean America. And when Srila Swami Maharaj Prabhupada went to America, before disembarking the ship, he wrote two poems, one prayer to the lotus feet of Krishna, and the other one about preaching Bhagavad Dharma in America. So that was the desire of Srila Saraswati Thakur, and by extension, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Mahaprabhu. But the world evolves, and we know that Krishna consciousness movement began to spread substantially and rapidly from America to Europe and Latin America, Australia. And in Prabhupada's final days, I had the opportunity to be preaching in Eastern Europe. And this was giving Prabhupada, he said, life and inspiration. And he saw, factoring in the difficulties, one book distributed there was worth, you know, 100 anywhere else. So it was he was very enlivened by that. And so the Krishna consciousness movement, in time, it spread through Eastern Europe, Russia, and like that. And then in Srila Govinda Maharaj's final days, Yudhamanya Prabhu began the preaching in China, and he's getting reports, and there are many quotes, but one of his famous quotes was that he said, after mixing with all of you, nothing will surprise me. He said, the only thing surprises me is that they are chanting Hare Krishna in China. So we know India has 1.3 billion people, and they all know who Krishna is. There were pictures this year on the internet from Janmashtami, and they showed even Muslim mothers dressing their little boys as Krishna. And you see these little boys with like blue faces and a flute and a dhoti, and their mothers are smiling. Muslim mothers dressing their child as Krishna for Janmashtami. It's that extensive in India. You know. So it sort of transcends what people would call as Hinduism and other festivals, but that's very, so it's just to make the point. So the 1.3 billion people in India, on some level, they know about Krishna and Radha and Krishna. And we know so many other gods, you know, Ganesh and Shiva and Ramachandra and Sita, they know these things. On some level, they have some appreciation for them. So India is, you know, known as Punya Bhumi, is one of its names. Means, you know, like the world of piety, the land of piety, because everyone there, but this sociologist, Pietrim Sorokin, considered sometimes the father of modern sociology, described India as a ideational culture, meaning every aspect of life is permeated by a metaphysical view of the world, life, existence. So the food, the movies, the clothing, you know, the vehicles have spiritual names, people's cars. And you still see this bus, and I like it because it said, Goswami Travels. And because they believe everything is like personal, ultimately, you'd see, like they have, you know, they would paint their vehicles too. They're not doing that with new cars, but they used to paint these buses and trucks. And you see where the fenders are to avoid fender benders, they paint eyes on them as if they can see to avoid hitting things. So that's the 1.3 billion people of India. But just across the border, the 1.6 billion people in China. Right? And China, in the last, I don't know how many years, but we'll say 20, but it's like 30, 40, the transition. Started with recognition in the 1970, but really in the 80s, 90s, started to become more open. The citizens starting to be able to travel outside of China and visit other parts of the world. And the opening of China, you can say also, coincided with the advent and proliferation of the internet. Almost at the same time, right? Hong Kong went back to China in 1997, I think. That was the year. And that's right around the time the internet was really starting to develop and onward. So now we're back to the first question, actually. So you see, the technology, development of technology intersected with a particular development of culture and society and suddenly made alternative forms of religion, ways of seeing the world, experience available to people. So, and we saw the current generation, younger generation of Chinese, that they are open to alternative worldviews. And as I've mentioned many times when I'm in China or to Chinese people, that generally the Chinese, for so many centuries, they did not take anything from outside. It's what's been described as insular, right? The so-called Great Wall of China and the insular culture. They're not taking things from beyond their own borders. But one thing they did import into China, because we know China is famous for export, not for import. But what they did import was Buddhism. That's very interesting. Whereas we could say, I mean, painting with a broad brush. The British went to India and they took the jewels from the deities and deities from the temples and so many things and put them in the British Museum. The Chinese, in their interaction with India, brought Buddhism back, not just material resources, but some spiritual substance. And the point I would make, because Buddhism is appreciated very much in China. And it's funny because now so many people there will say that they are Buddhist. When did they suddenly become Buddhist? Or were they Buddhist all along? Right? Because you weren't supposed to be a Buddhist so many years ago. And now everybody, more or less, will say that they're Buddhist. I say, that's fine. You know, Das Avatars, Keshava Drita Buddha Sharira Jaya Jagadisha Hare. You know, Buddha is an incarnation of Krishna. So Buddha is Krishna, showing himself in a particular way. Still, without going into that, so this is the one thing they brought, import. Everything else, export. This, they imported, right? Buddhism. So this is the point to consider, is where does Buddhism, what position does Buddhism occupy in the theistic system of India, of Vedic culture? We find it has a particular place. It's not the sum total, it's one aspect. Buddha is one, Das avatars, 10 avatars of Krishna, Buddha is one of them. Ete cha angsa kalak pungsa Krishnastu Bhagavan Shrayam. But Krishna is the source of all of these incarnations. Then someone could inquire, oh, what are the other incarnations? What were their functions? What were their purposes? What is the purpose of the Buddha avatar? So our turning toward China, coincides with its current cultural openness of the younger generation, the proliferation of the internet, and the suggesting to the Chinese people that there's more than Buddhism to be imported from Vedic culture. So you already embraced part of it. So try and understand there's a system there. And this generation is uniquely poised to appreciate that. So that's why.
Although there are more people in India, they believe in Krishna, but comparatively speaking, this is a poor country. So,
materially poor.
Yes. So she's asking, if believing in Krishna can bring people fortune, wealth, so
that's a very Chinese question. We have to understand what is real wealth. The idea that the pursuit of Krishna consciousness will result in, you know, economic development is not being promoted. Right? In Vedic culture, you have four things to consider: dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Dharma, means loosely regulating your life according to revealed truth, scriptures, religion. Artha means economic development. Dharma, artha, kama, kam means enjoyment, mundane enjoyment. Moksha, the fourth, is liberation. So there's some people who think the life cycle is already like this. You know, when you're young, there's the more the brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. This is back to varnashram, that in the life cycle, that one will go through this sequence. But actually, Krishna consciousness proper, moksha means liberation. To be liberated from material entanglement. You don't have to wait till you're older to pursue that. And on the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam, we say, Muktir Hadvanyata Rupam Swaropena Vivastiti. Real liberation means to reawaken your servitor identity, as opposed to being an exploiting agent, trying to exploit the world to your advantage. Here, one is reconfigured as a dedicating unit, a servitor. Instead of trying to acquire, control, and consume things which are lower than us, we're being reconfigured to dedicate ourselves to what is higher than us. That's the proper approach to what is higher, to offer yourself in service as opposed to try and exploit something. Still, those four things, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. But we're told Vishwanath Chakravarti Tagore, he says, Srimad Bhagavatam Pramana Mamalam Prema Pumarto Mahan. Or Mahaprabhu, as they say, Panchama Purushartha, the fifth Dharma Artha Kama Moksha, four. The fifth and ultimate goal of life, Prem, the pursuit of Krishna, Prem, love of God. So, the real wealth of India is not measured in terms of its economic growth. Although, just as an odd fact, right now, it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. Right? That's not what we are to get from India. I think, all these material goods that have been produced by China, now let India try. This is useless, a useless idea. Right? The spiritual wealth that's been the real, true, substantial wealth of India, that we're interested in. As I told, the Chinese, they didn't go to India just to get a better deal. But they brought Buddhism back to China, seeing that that was valuable. Because this has to do with internal culture, internal wealth, internal development. The idea that, you know, I'll get some mantra, I'll chant that mantra, and it'll bring me material success, is not only not being encouraged, you know, we are against that. That's using the higher to serve the lower. It's the opposite of Krishna culture.
If Krishna is the supreme being, is the God of all gods, but why people all around the world, they know more about Buddha, Jesus, they are Buddhist, Christians, and so less people?
Well, John Lennon said once, he said about the Beatles, we're more popular than Jesus. Right? And many people were upset. But he was lamenting. He's saying, what kind of world is this? We're more popular than Jesus. So we could now name so many movie stars or pop stars who are more popular than divine personalities. So it's not a popularity contest. Or if we say, well, most ignorant people, they're familiar with others. That's not a sensible argument that it's not democracy. We're going to vote. Who gets the most votes to be God? Right? So you have to approach this systematically. So these incarnations of God, avatars, where are they described? They're described in Vedic literature. Right, as you mentioned, Das Avatars, Buddha is mentioned. Right? But Varaha, Nrisinga, Kurma, Matsya, Vaman, right? Kalki, Parashuram, Krishna, Balaram, who did I not mention? Hayagriva. And so anyway, they're mentioned in Vedic literature. They're mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam, that verse I just quoted that ends in Prema Pumarta Mahan begins with Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanamamalam. And of all this Vedic truth, this is the most pure evidence. It's the ultimate authoritative source, is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Out of all the Vedic literatures, Puranas, etc. This is the supreme book, is Srimad Bhagavatam. And therein it says, Ete cha angsa kalak pungsa krishnastu bhagavan svayam. Right? That all these different incarnations who've been mentioned, they're either parts, expansions, or part of a part, but Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan, the original. So this is on the basis of Vedic evidence. Right? Brahma Sanghita, Ishvara Parama Krishna, the supreme Ishvara, the Parameshwara, supreme controller, the supreme God is Krishna. And one of his names also, Deva Deva, the God's God. So that's on the strength of Vedic literature. Right? Not a popularity contest.
But like most people, they haven't read about Bhagavad Gita or the Vedas.
Yes. And
they only know about the three main gods in Hindu religion. They don't know about Krishna. So what is the relationship between Krishna and Hinduism?
Well, what I just described is that among Vedic literature, the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is the Mahapurana, right? It's the ultimate evidence. So in there, for example, you mentioned Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. There's the Brahma Vimohan Leela. So Brahma is generally considered the creator, right, of the world, four-headed Brahma. He, at the conclusion of one of Krishna's pastimes, the killing of Aghasura, demigods are singing and dancing, and Brahma is on his planet, the topmost planet in the spiritual sky, and he hears these devas and devis, they're all singing and dancing. He can hear that, it's traveling through the ethereal world, right? You understand? They're on heavenly planets, but Brahma Loka is the topmost planet. But the subtle vibration of their singing and dancing is reaching Brahma Loka, and he's thinking, what's the commotion about? What's the celebration about? So Brahma, whose carrier is a swan, he comes from Brahmaloka, and he sees these gods and goddesses madly dancing, celebrating Krishna's killing of Aghasura. Right? And he's thinking, why are these grown men and women, you know, who are gods and goddesses, worshiping this little boy? Because Krishna's there as a five-year-old boy, right? You know, sitting on the banks of the Jamuna with his cowherd friends. They're having a picnic. And Krishna has food in his left hand, and he's eating like that. And they're all laughing and smiling and teasing one another. Right? And they're playing. And he's thinking, this boy, this is, these gods and goddesses are making fools out of themselves by worshiping this child. So he's thinking a scheme to reveal their foolishness to them. Right? As Brahma, he's described as Atmabhu, means he's born from the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, the Purusha avatar. So he understands Narayan as God. What to speak of these people that you're mentioning? Brahma, in this pastime, he doesn't know about Krishna's divinity, so they shouldn't feel bad. They're in good company. no less than Brahma, of that triad, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, he doesn't know either. So it's all good. So Brahma thinks, he sees Krishna there with the calves. He's so young, he's not herding cows yet, he's herding calves. Right? So the little calves are there with Krishna and his friends. And he thinks, I'll steal his friends and the calves, and then probably he'll start crying for his mother or something. And then everyone will see it. These gods and goddesses will come to their senses and stop worshiping this little boy. He may be cute, he may be charming, but they should come to their senses. So he steals all the calves and the cowherd boys and hides them in a cave on Brahmaloka, his planet. Right? Then he's saying, like, now let's see. Probably crying mom or for his mother. And he looks back and he sees all the calves are there and all the cowherd boys. Then Brahma starts thinking, like, maybe he's middle-aged or getting older. Brahma lives for over 300 trillion years. Maybe he's been around for 150 trillion or, you know, he's thinking, maybe his memory is going bad. So he's thinking, like, wait, I just put the calves and the cows and the cowherd boys in the cave. He looks back in the cave on Brahmaloka and they're like in some sort of state of sleep or suspended animation. Then he looks back again and sees there's Krishna still laughing, eating, playing on the banks of the Jamuna, and all the calves and cowherd boys are still there. Then Brahma starts looking more with greater scrutiny, and he sees that suddenly they all have four arms. They're all four-armed Vishnu forms. Then he's saying, now I'm really losing my mind. So he sees they all have four-armed Vishnu forms, and then he sees that everything, everything is dancing and worshiping Krishna. The blades of grass, they're dancing and worshiping Krishna. Even abstract things like the directions is in a dance and worshiping and praising Krishna. And he sees innumerable Shivas, Brahmas, Vishnu, and his four heads are spinning. And this pastime is called the Brahma Vimohan Leela, where Brahma is bewildered. Vimohan means, you know, put into illusion. And he is one of those guna avatars, right, of the Brahma Vishnu Shiva triad. Right? So, and that Brahma, he falls down before the five-year-old Krishna and starts offering prayers to him. One beginning, no mijate abra vapuse taridambaraya gunjava tanksa paripichchala sanmukhaya vanya shvaje kavalaveta vishana venu lakshma shmiye mridupade pashupankajaya. He's saying, it's very difficult to understand who you are. Like, who's asking? He's saying, because abravapu, because of your black beauty, your dark complexion, which is like a monsoon rain cloud. He's saying, but taridambaraya, dressed in your lightning yellow dhoti, that contrasts your spiritual beauty and reveals you. So Srila Guru Maharaj says that represents Ladini Shakti, Krishna's potency, Radharani. His Shakti reveals him. So, and he says in this prayer, Gunjava Tanksha, Paripichchala Sanmukhaya. You look like a little boy. You have the peacock feather on your head. You're wearing gunjamala from the forest of Vrindavan. You have a stick in your waist, food in your left hand, a flute, bamboo flute stuffed on the other side of your waist. And your steps are very measured. He's a child. Remember, he's the infinite. As the Vaman avatar, he in two steps, he covers the entire universe. But what? As a dwarf. A dwarf should have the smallest steps, right? It shows, you know, some humor. A dwarf would take two little steps. He's saying, oh, I just, you know, three steps of land for me. Bali Maharaj is saying, obviously, you're not very experienced in the world. One can use more than three steps of land. So ask for something more. And what does Vamandev say? Well, I've heard it's not good for your spiritual advancement to covet more than you actually need. And he's as a little dwarf brahmachari. And Bali Maharaj is saying, he's a dwarf, three steps is, you know, what is that going to be? And but Vamandev saying, no, three steps will be fine for me. But he's omnipotent, even as a dwarf. So in two steps, he covers the entire universe. And where does he put the third step? He's saying, you owe me a third step. Bali Maharaj is saying, place it on my head. That's the last thing. And that's what he wanted all along, Vamandev, is Bali Maharaj to offer himself. Taking all the other stuff was insignificant and nothing. And but only Bali Maharaj can offer himself. So Brahma is saying, and your steps, the way you move, it says in the Vedas, Adbhutakram, he of wonderful stride. He's saying, and your walking is very beautiful. A Prakriti Lila means human-like. Krishna is just a little five-year-old boy, so that means his steps are also small. Sometimes Rupa Goswami said, he, like a little baby elephant, the way they walk. So he's walking like that. Brahma says, oh, that is, he's starting to see the beauty, charm, and sweetness of Krishna. And he's saying, and normally we're told the Lord is yajna-bhuk. He only eats the remnants of sacrifice, right? With the mantras, the fire, and all the prayers. And after a long, long time, then you can distribute that to everyone. Yajna-bhuk, he eats through yajna. And he's saying, but who's supposed to be yajna-bhuk? Sitting on the banks of the Jamuna with his cowherd boyfriends, and they're having a picnic, and they're playing around, and he's got food in his left hand, and he's eating that, and very happy. No apparent yajna going on for yajna-bhuk. So Brahma, I mean, this is the first prayer where he's now falling on his hands and knees, crying, tears. He more or less faints and wakes up, and he sees Krishna. And one of the prayers, he says, you know, Narayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam. So imagine Brahma, the Lord of the universe, he's saying to five-year-old Krishna, are you not my father, Narayan? And Krishna's saying, I'm 5 years old. How can I be your father? This is crazy. And Brahma's saying, no. And then Brahma starts explaining the expansions of the Lord, the different types of expansions there are in seeing, and you're the original source of them. So since you're the source of Narayan, and I came out of the navel, a lotus flower sprung from the navel of Garbhadakshai Vishnu, then are you not really my father? So that's one pastime, the Brahma Vimohan Leela. Indra Mohan. Indra is also bewildered in the Govardhan Leela. In the ninth canto, Shiva and Mohini Murti. And what do we hear in the tenth canto? That Vishnu, he steals the son, the Brahmin boy, and Krishna and Krishna and Arjun, they, let me say, transcend the eight cells, layers of the universe, and they go to see Vishnu, and they're wondering, like, why is Vishnu kidnapping people? Right? That's just not something he normally does. And then what does Vishnu say? He said, I wanted to see you, my Lord. So Vishnu wanted to see the beauty of Krishna. So here you have Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, all enamored by the beauty of Krishna. And what do we hear? That what to speak of them? When Dwaraka Krishna sees a photo or a picture of Krishna from Vrindavan, it awakens some eagerness within him to see Krishna. Or we're told sometimes he sees his reflection in a jeweled column or a fountain, and he said, who is this person who possesses such beauty that it's awakening the sentiments, the feelings of Radharani within me? So, we can't haphazardly or cherry-pick little things from the Puranas and Vedic literature about Vishnu, Shiva, Brahma, and we have to look at it comprehensively. The Bhagavatam is the ultimate authority for this sort of analysis. And there, so it said, when Suta Goswami is thinking, all these sages here, when they hear in this list of incarnations that Krishna is included, because there's a way in which the incarnations appear in this world through Kiradakshai Vishnu, Ananta Shesh, there's a way they descend in this world. Since Krishna is in the list, he's thinking, they may just think he's one of them. So after he mentions here, and 24, in fact, he says, Ete cha angsa kalak pungsa Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. But Krishna is the original.
What is Shiva's story that he's enamored by Krishna?
It's in the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. We know if everyone here has been to the Suvarnabhumi airport, right? Of course. And what's depicted there in immigration is the churning of the milk ocean by the devas and the asuras. But they're showing Kurma in a Vishnu form, right? But that pastime, we're told, the devas, the gods, and the asuras, their demonic counterparts, they have a joint effort to, they want to try and achieve amrita, or nectar. The word mrityu means death. Amrita is that substance that makes you immortal. Right? Like everybody wants to live forever. So they're, even though they have extensive lifespans, according to Vedic literature, they want to get amrita, right? The so-called nectar of immortality. So like when you churn milk, can produce different things. So they want to churn the milk ocean, right? This is problematic for them, how to do that. So what do we have is that the Kurma avatar appears, the tortoise incarnation. And what is his predicament? He has an itch on the center of his back. So this is what's charming about it, is that you think, well, if God is omnipotent, he can do anything. And people pose all these ridiculous questions. Can he do this? Can he do that? You know, can he make a rock so heavy he can't lift it? You know. So, but here's something very simple. As the Korma avatar, he has an itch on his back and he cannot reach it. Right? Who's in one step, two steps could cover the universe. In this pastime, his play is he cannot reach that itch. So what do they do? He's playing in the milk ocean. So they put the Mandara mountain, he's rather large. They put a mountain on the center of his back, wrap the celestial serpent Vasuki, and you can see this at the Suvarnabhumi airport. Right? And then on one side are the devas, the demigods, the other side the asura demons, and they're using the serpent as the churning rope. Just like, it goes like that. And that makes the mountain go back and forth, and that's relieving the itch. It's churning the milk ocean and simultaneously relieving the itch of Korma avatar. So it's described in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, Prishte Brahmya, Brahmya Ramanda Mandara Giri Gravagya Kandu Yanan Nidralo Kamatakriter Kandu Yanan, I forget the rest, but saying how when that itch is being relieved, just like a person here, they go like, ah. Oh. So as his itch is being relieved, his outward going breath of satisfaction and relief is generating the Vedas, which is that sound vibration that will liberate everyone. So these are the pastimes of divinity. And from that ocean, who's being turned? The moon, Chandraloka, the Chandravamsa, in which Krishna will appear. So there are allusions to the ultimate pastimes of Krishna, Madhura Rasa. Lakshmi Devi is generated from there. Indra's elephant, Airavata. Many things. And if you go to Cambodia and in the museum, in Cambodia, they've taken many things from the Angkor Wat temple, where this pastime is the principal pastime being displayed there, right? So this pastime is very famous in Southeast Asia, all over Southeast Asia. What the significance is another thing, and that I'll reveal what Guru Maharaj said. But anyway, so many things are being generated from there. So they're churning. They want to get that amrita, the nectar of immortality. And when it's finally produced, they're told, Krishna takes an apparently female form, Mohini, Murti, and collects all the nectar in a pot. And as she is running away with the pot, they're all enamored by her. Particularly the asuras, the demons, they're enamored by her. And as that she's carrying that pot away, we're talking, some of the nectar from the pot falls and lands in different places. One of the places it lands is the site of the Kumbh Mela. Kumbh means pot. So where that nectar landed, that's that annual festival they have in India where 1 million people go. And sometimes millions of people, they have it, you know, there's the Adha Kumbha, the Maha Kumbha, because there's every 6 years, 12 years, 144 years. So they go there, millions of people, and bathe in the Ganga to this day, right? Kumbha means pot. So as legend has it, a drop of that divine nectar fell in that spot. But Srila Guru Maharaj says, really, what is there? Because I asked, why is this pastime, which is in the 9th canto, referenced again at the end of the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam? And the last chapter, which is a very small chapter, so for something to be in there, it has to be very significant. So Guru Maharaj told me, he said, because what they're searching for is the ultimate nectarine substance. And the Bhagavatam is presenting the ultimate nectarine substance in the form of the pastimes, Madhura Rasa pastimes, of Krishna, Radharani, and Braja Gopis. And that's why it's being referenced again. The thing, that's the ultimate substance. The Bhagavatam's not promoting generic immortality. Just live forever and do what? Right? No, it's about the ultimate nectarine substance, Amrita, is Madhura Rasa, as expressed in the pastimes of Radharani, Krishna, and Braja Gopis. But that said, shortly after this, Shiva, when you churn, you get like the good stuff, and then there's the not so good stuff. So the throwaway was all poisonous substances. The venom of serpents, of cobras, and other such animals, different types of intoxicants, that was the waste product of the ocean of nectar. And then the gods were wondering, how are we going to deal with this? So they petitioned Shiva. And Shiva came, and Shiva takes all the poison. He kneels down and takes all the poison, which is oceanic itself, and he drinks that. And it doesn't affect him. The only effect it has upon him is it turns his neck blue, like peacock blue. So one of his names is Nilakanta. Nil means blue, Kanta means neck. Nilakanta. Right? So again, in the Bhagavatam, with reference to Madhura Rasa pastime, they say, don't try to imitate this or prematurely approach these pastimes with your mental intellectual ability. It's saying like, unless like Shiva, you can drink an ocean of poison, you won't be able to digest these pastimes. So a caution is given. But that Shiva, so he's called to play this role in the pastime, but he has a glimpse of Mohini Murti, and he is enamored, enchanted by her. And Mohini Murti it's actually funny. She's bouncing a ball and dancing around, and Shiva, like, in front of his wife, he's uncontrollably enamored by the beauty of Mohini Murti. And other things are described there that I'm not going to say. You can read them. But he's definitely, in the presence of his wife, enamored by the beauty of Mohini Murti. And he has some epiphany in the process. So we have example of Brahma Vimohan, Mohini Murti for Shiva, Indra Mohan in the Govardhan Leela, and Vishnu himself desiring to see. He's not, his is not a Mohan, a bewilderment, but he is charmed by the sweetness of the beauty of Krishna. And he's Vishnu, who's inconceivably beautiful himself, but there's something extra charming and sweet about Krishna that's not being expressed in the Vishnu Murti, and he wants to see that himself. And as we had Yadvanchana Sri Lalana Charatapo, Lakshmi Devi did austerities in the Tapovan for lifetimes to enter the sweet pastimes of Krishna. Lakshmi of Vaikuntha, the consort of Narayan, of Vishnu. So in many different ways, the acharyas, Rupa Goswami included, they're showing the supremacy of Krishna. And specifically, Swayam Bhagavan means Krishna at the right hand of Radharani. Even Dwaraka Krishna is attracted to Vrindavan Krishna. That's what's being, in this way you can see the gradation. The whole world under the influence of Madan, Cupid, Eros, Freud, says the sexual principle is the driving principle of material existence, of everything. Right? He discovered something that was already expressed in Vedic understanding. Madan is the Sanskrit word. What is Krishna's name? Madan Mohan. Who can, everyone's being, man, woman, is bewildered by Cupid, but Cupid is bewildered by the beauty and seductive attractiveness of Krishna. So Madan Mohan. And what is Radharani's name? Madan Mohan Mohini. That Krishna, he's bewildered by the beauty of Radharani. Hare Krishna.